spacecraft undocks from the space station. They're attached to the IDA, the International Docking Adapter, which is attached to the PMA 2 with pressure rating adapter. And they'll pull away, and they'll deorbit and head for the Atlantic Ocean using a heat shield going up to about 3,000 degrees. Four parachutes eventually open up, and they will land in the Atlantic Ocean to be picked up by a SpaceX ship. Once that's completed, that will complete the whole test of the Crew Dragon vehicle, the launch, the docking, the undocking, and the landing, which has been in the works since 2011 was the last flight up to the space station almost 9 years ago by Atlantis. And one of the people on board Atlantis was Doug Hurley, the commander of this mission. And one of the things that they left behind on that mission was a flag, an American flag, attached to the door where you first come in, that opens up, looks like a garage door, it slides up. And it's been sitting there for the last 9 years. And the idea is, it's sort of like the capture flag game. The idea is, whatever American crew came up next, they were going to be the ones to take that flag and bring it back down. And it was a bit of a competition between SpaceX and Boeing. Boeing has the Starliner that they're building that will eventually go up early next year with a crew of three. And they were hoping to bring that flag back, you know, a badge of honor type of thing. But the flag, it turns out, has history. Back in 1981, the first space shuttle mission with Bob Crippen on board and John Young, when they went up, they took an American flag up, and it turns out that this was that same flag. They did their trip, came back, and then eventually they decided to send it back up on this mission. And I thought, well, maybe this flag is going to wind up in the Smithsonian, you know, when they bring it back, which, you know, they will keep it safe, NASA will keep it safe. But it will go up again, you know, one more time for the first crew, American crew, that leaves Earth orbit, you know, whether they're going to an asteroid or going to the moon or to Mars, wherever they're going, that flag will fly again. So, yeah, it's only about, it looks like about a foot long, American flag. So I thought I'd tell that story. Any comments or questions before I go on? This is WS2M. Okay, very good. So, the booster that landed after launch, this 155-foot booster, 12 feet in diameter with four legs that open up the last few seconds right before landing, landed on this autonomous drone ship. The name of it is Just Read the Instructions. That's the name of the ship. It's one of SpaceX's ships sitting out by the Carolinas and a couple of hundred miles out, probably about 400 miles out, and it successfully landed. It was a nice flight. It successfully landed on that ship. Correction, there's two ships. This one is the other ship. Not just Read the Instructions. That was the next flight. Anyway, it successfully landed on the autonomous ship, and then it was towed back into Cape Canaveral. I do have a picture of that thing being brought back in. And it's brought back in standing up. And how do they do that? How do they secure it like that? Once it lands, they used to have a crew go from another ship, board the autonomous ship, and they used to set out all these different legs and stands and weld things to the deck to support the, with that jack and everything, in case it wasn't quite vertical, and then they would weld it to the ship, and it would come back that way. A bit dangerous, you know. This thing actually went over when you had a crew there. That could be a little harmful. So over the last 2 years, they invented the Octagrabber. The Octagrabber is this eight-sided gadget that comes out of the, let's call it a garage, on one side of the ship. Right after it lands and the flames go out, this door opens up, you know, and this is all automatic. There's nobody on the ship. And the Octagrabber comes riding out and finds itself under, directly under the center of the Falcon 9 booster. And it's got these four hydraulics that move these two arms up, and they've got these big heavy-duty claws on the top of the arms, and they grab a hold of the bottom of the booster, and they're the hold-down pieces that are, you know, that normally hold the booster in place on the launch pad. So they're very strong, and they're positioned just in the right spot. So it reaches up, grabs it, and pulls it down. It's a very heavy, let's call it a robotic octograbber. So that this thing doesn't move. It's very secure. And then it stays like that until it's brought back to the Cape. So that worked out fine. And he's been doing this, this is around the 51st or 52nd. Booster that they've caught either on the ship or sometimes back at land. They have a landing zone. They call it Landing Zone 1 back in Florida. And, you know, not to be outdone, but the next week, actually a few days ago, they launched, let's see, I think it was today's what, Sunday, probably Wednesday, they launched another Falcon 9 rocket up to up to space, and this time they were carrying 60 satellites, communication satellites. It's part of the Starlink program. It's the seventh time they've done this. The large satellites, each one is like 500 pounds, so it's like a 30,000 pound plus payload that they send up, at the top of the booster. So it gets up. That goes, goes up into space, and again the booster itself, the first stage, comes back down, and they landed on the other ship. Now this ship, just read the instructions, was still busy with the first booster that launched the two astronauts to space in port in Florida. It used to be on the West Coast. It used to catch the boosters as they launched out of Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. But the flights out of there have been pretty minimal. There are more flights that are being launched from Florida. So they do have a landing site in California. If need be, they could fly a booster back to a landing site. But now that they have two of these ships, they're big. They're 300 feet by, 150 feet wide. So plenty of room to land this thing. They have a big, instead of an X, they have the SpaceX symbol on it, And it's pretty much, most of the times, it lands right there, a couple of feet away from the center. Which is pretty good from all the way in out of space. I think they start up, they get around 60 miles high, and then they come back down. They have to go on over 3,000 miles an hour, and you can see they're all burnt up a little bit, but they reuse them. They definitely reuse them. And the one that went up on the crew vehicle was brand new booster. So that, brand new spacecraft, the Dragon crew vehicle, and brand new booster. But this last flight that just went up with the Starlink, sending these 60 satellites, into orbit, was the fifth time that booster has taken off and landed on a ship somewhere. So they keep reusing these things over and over. Once in a while, they might miss, and then they'll have to, scratch that one off the future manifest list. But this one made it. It's the most times they've saved the booster. So this one is 5 times, and they plan on reusing it again. When these Block 5 boosters were being developed, they started with, you know, Block 1, Block 2, Block 3, you know, different iterations as time went on. Each one got stronger, you know, another one wound up with legs, another one wound up with fins near the top that actuate to control the booster as it enters the atmosphere. Each iteration was better, and this is the final iteration, this Block 5 one. The other ones were reused, you know, maybe 2 times. I think Block 4 was, they used one of those 3 times. But this latest version is designed to be reused 10 times without major, refabrication of the engines and everything. They pretty much just clean them up and change out maybe some of the piping that might be involved. If there's a problem, you know, they have like a heat shield surrounding the engines now. So it's pretty well protected. So they pretty much fuel them up and let them go again. But this one here will be able to reuse 10 times and then refurbish it and then 10 times again and so on and so forth. Theoretically, you could use one of these boosters 100 times before they throw them away. So that's what SpaceX is up to for reusability and for consistency, for driving the price down. NASA's price for a manned mission is, you know, the Atlas V rocket they used, and that's around $350 million every time they launch that. They're trying to drive that price down a little bit, but they're not reusable. They go up into space, booster comes down into the ocean, and you know, that's the end of that. But SpaceX has been reusing these things, and their price is coming further and further down. I remember a couple of years ago, it was around $62 million. They said the one that they went up, just went up with the crew, cost them about $50 million for launch. So that's pretty good. And as time goes on and the reusability and the system gets better and better, the price could even come down even further. And that leaves all these other companies, you know, with a problem. They have to compete against that. So that's the story with that. Right before the crew launched, May 30th, the last day of the month there. The day before, Elon Musk on SpaceX, he wanted to test out the fourth version of his Starship. He's building this Starship. The Starship is, the ultimate purpose of the Starship vehicle is to go to Mars. And he's been building these things for the last couple of years, turning them out like one right after the other. Why does he do that? Because they keep blowing up or collapsing. He's only trying to build right now the second stage, which is big. It's, you know, by when it's done, it's going to be 200 feet tall. And then, you know, we'll include cabins, and you would be able to put like 40 people on board this thing. So, you know, this one is going to have 6 engines and much more powerful than the Merlin D engine. Well, nevertheless, it's a much more powerful vehicle. And it's only the top part. It's what's considered the second stage and the crew compartment is what he's trying to build now. After that, finally able to fly and come back and land vertically, just like they do with the Falcon 9. He would eventually build this, they call it the Heavy. It'll be the Starship Heavy. And instead of just having 6 of these Raptor engines, By the way, each Raptor engine is probably over 2.5 times more powerful than each Merlin D engine. You know, by the time you're done, he's got to have 34 of these engines on the main first booster, which will deliver like minimum of 13 million pounds of thrust, which is over twice the amount of thrust that the Apollo moon vehicle had. That's his ultimate goal, and that will be able to, you know, not only go to Mars, you know, he wants to make trips to the moon as well. With the first stage, Starship Heavy, and the second stage, which he's developing right now. And he's building these things down in Texas, down a place called Boca Chica, Texas. He was starting to build them also in Florida, too, but he put that on hold for a while, and he's just concentrating on Boca Chica until he can get one of these things to fly. The last one that he was trying to get ready, the day before the crew took off, blew up. I mean, it just blew up. There was nothing left. And he was just testing an engine, testing, you know, he fueled the vehicle. By the way, it uses liquid methane and liquid oxygen. It doesn't use liquid kerosene like the Falcon 9 does. It uses liquid methane. But there's a pull-out joint that's supposed to pull out at the bottom. That didn't happen right during this test, and the whole thing just blew. I mean, it came out, leaked all over. I mean, thousands of gallons of liquid methane, and then it ignited and picked up a spark from somewhere because they had just tested the engine. They only had one Raptor engine in it, one of the new engines. So, of course, that's gone. And so was the test facility. So they're spending a lot of time rebuilding the test facility. The new rocket is almost built because he was building it anyway. So this was the fourth version that blew up, and now he's got the fifth version ready to put back on a test stand. They think they're going to have the test stand completed by this week on the 10th, and by the following week they expect to try testing this rocket again. And the goal is just to see if they can get this thing off the launch pad. They want to bring it up around 500 feet and then come back and land, you know, right where they started, pretty much, you know, a couple hundred feet over. And once they do that, then they plan on going up a little higher, maybe 1,000 feet or so. And then the third flight, they plan on going up about 12 miles into the atmosphere. 12 miles up, and then come back to where they, you know, the same place they took off in Boca Chica, Texas. And, you know, it's not orbital, but it's suborbital. And then, you know, each time after that, progressively higher and higher. And his ultimate goal is to be able to fly this thing directly from the ground and actually put it into orbit as a test, really just to see if he can do it. Which would involve six of these engines. Just to do this 12-mile high test, he needs three engines. To put it into orbit, he'll have to put six engines in it, and three of the regular engines, and then, you know, they're called Raptor engines, and then he'll have three more engines. They're Raptor, but they're optimized for vacuum use for orbit, for space. So it will be a total of six engines. He'll go up probably with three, and then the other three will continue on until he gets to orbit, and then deorbit and see if he can come back to Boca Chica, Texas again. That's the ultimate goal. Once he does that, he's, you know, he's pushing hard. I guess he feels maybe he's getting older. He wants to get this done real quick. He's really, I mean, accelerating this project. And then he'll start building the heavy, the Starship Heavy booster. And that'll be the one with 33, 34 engines. And then he'll test that in the same way. Ultimate goal, that 33 Raptor engine will eventually come back and land back in Boca Chica, refuel it, and be able to send it back up. The second stage, which he's building now, will continue on, and maybe refuel in space from another one of these similar types of rockets that he's building. Completely refuel. Now he's got a whole, you know, it's like the same rocket except he's, you know, refueled like just like he took off from Earth. And once in orbit, you don't need much fuel to get out of orbit. And next thing you know, he can get to the moon. He can actually land vertically on the moon, take off vertically from the moon, and actually come back to Earth. And in the long run, his ultimate goal, since he started this company, SpaceX, which I think was around 12, 13 years ago, is to go to Mars. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N. Well, every week, everybody listens. We always, they always have to listen to me talk about SpaceX because they are the, they are out there. Between NASA and SpaceX, NASA plays everything safely. They move along at a steady pace. They're still building the STS launch system with the Orion spacecraft, the Gateway space station, which will be put into orbit around the moon. They've already let out a contract for development to Northrop Grumman for the, they call it the HALO, the habitation unit. And that amounts to one big module. And originally I was going to be launched separate to orbit the moon as a space part of the space station. And it was going to dock up with the PPE. And PPE is not, and we think of that as all the protection stuff for coronavirus, but in NASA's world, the PPE was the power propulsion element. And power propulsion element was also going to be launched separately by another big rocket. And they were going to be orbiting the moon, and then they were going to dock there, and that would be the beginning of the space station. You'd have a habitat module, and you'd have a power from the sun, and propulsion. They'll have an engine, including an ion engine. And just recently, last week, they said, no, we're not going to do it that way. We're going to put them together on Earth first. And forget about docking in around the moon. Why take a chance? Let's put it together on Earth. And launch it on one of these big vehicles, either STS or most likely, knowing these guys, they'll hire either SpaceX to launch it, or they might send it up on a new vehicle being built by Jeff Bezos at Blue Origins called the New Glenn, which is another massive rocket. You know, it stands about the same height as the Saturn V rocket, but it, you know, as yet it has not flown. So but that's the goal, to send the two units up, and that would be called the Gateway. And they would be orbiting the moon, and you would have a spacecraft like Orion and the STS launch from Earth, go to the moon, and dock. The original plan is to do this, to dock with the space station that's going around the moon. And it's not, you know, it's not a low orbit. We're talking about a eccentric orbit, you know, maybe 40,000 kilometers out from the moon, and then, you know, maybe 1,000 kilometers near the moon. Eccentric orbit. They call it a HALO, or rectus cilia engine, rectilinear orbit. And, you know, dock with that. And then there would be a transfer vehicle. They'd get into the transfer vehicle to get down to low orbit, you know, 60 miles above the surface of the moon. And then from there, they would get into another vehicle and land on the moon with a landing vehicle. And then reverse that process to go back up. And this would be done with four astronauts, you know, launch from the moon, connect to the transfer vehicle in low moon orbit, and then the transfer vehicle would bring back to the space station in this high, extremely elliptical orbit around the moon. And because the present administration would like to land somebody on the moon in 2024. Now, if you listen to me, this is not going to happen over the years, because there's no way to have the funds to do this. But you never know, they might get it. And then if they do, he would that they'd all have the time to develop a system to do what I just said. They'll just take an SLS rocket with an Orion spacecraft that NASA's building now and launch it in 2024 to the moon, go around and orbit around the moon. Up with a landing vehicle there, you know, similar to what we have here at LEM, but, you know, maybe three times as big. And then that vehicle will go directly down to the moon. No transfer vehicle, no nothing, and then come back up again. Almost very similar to what Apollo did. The only difference is on Apollo, we took our landing vehicle with us in one piece. You know, the LEM and the Apollo went together on one launch vehicle called the Saturn V. This would be done in two launches. One launch would put the lunar landing vehicle in orbit, and then the second launch would send the crew in the Orion vehicle dock with it in low Earth low lunar orbit, and then land on the moon. So that's the plan for the not too distant future. So, and we'll see how they work out one way or the other. There's an outside chance Musk might beat everybody. But SpaceX, he might, come along and just do what I said earlier, put together his Starship vehicle, the main booster with the 33 engines, have that land back at Florida, second stage go up directly to the moon and land, and, he might be the one carrying the American flag that Doug Hurley will be bringing back after this mission is over at the International Space Station. Any questions or comments?
W2SAW?
W, sure, go ahead.
Hi, name's Bill Paul. Just curious, if SpaceX manages to send a group of people to Mars, do they expect to be able to bring them back again and have enough fuel to get them back to Earth?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. This is in a suicide mission like Mars One. Remember that story about Mars One? That guy from the... he was from the Netherlands. Bass, I forget his name. Bass, I think. He put together this whole deal where people pouring in money to be the astronauts that are going to go on his trip to Mars and just land. And one-way trip, we're not going to bring you back, but, you could live your life out on Mars. It's nothing like that. Of course, that was nonsense. But it made a lot of press, TV, interviews, and bankruptcy. So that was the end of that guy. This is a real program where he plans on, he's got to get to the moon first. He's got to help out NASA with his dev flights. But in the long run, his goal is to land on the moon, land on Mars, and of course, the long-term goal, remember, is to make a two-planet society. So, he envisions thousands of people going to Mars. But in the beginning, he would land on Mars, and he'd already have set up there from unmanned vehicles. And one of those vehicles would be taking the atmosphere of Mars and converting it into liquid oxygen and even methane. You could break down the carbon dioxide that's on Mars, and through something called a Saboteur piece of equipment, you could actually create all these different chemicals that he would need, liquid methane and liquid oxygen, to refuel vehicles. So here he comes, he lands his vehicle down on Mars, and now he needs to be refueled. And this fueling station would be able to do that. I mean, that's the beginning. He needs some kind of infrastructure on Mars. He's just not going to land somebody and leave them there. And then once they're there, they will have to stay for quite a while because Mars and Earth only come close to one another every 26 months. So let's say it was this July when it's going to be closest to to Earth for a mission, and here we are in the future. But let's say like this July, he launches to Mars, he lands a crew on Mars. They're not coming back right away. They're going to hang out for a while. It takes them 8 months to get there, six or 8 months to get there, and then have to stay there for a year or so. Set up some kind of a camp and power systems and a real infrastructure would probably be needed before he even attempts to do this. And then after that, when you're Mars and Earth are close together, he'll be able to come back and send that crew back to Earth. And then as time goes on, every time they're in line, you'd send another rocket or two. And he plans on building. And I read this, and I thought this was a joke. Talk about far out things. Let me drop it. His goal is to mass produce these starships. And I had to read it twice. I had to read it in a lot of different interviews that he had, and then I actually saw it in an interview with Elon Musk. He plans on building like 1,000 of these rockets that will be able to carry. Originally, he thought he was going to carry 100 people at one time, and then as the years went by, I heard it's around 40. So 40 people would be able to travel to Mars at one time, and he would eventually set up this Mars colony. So if we all live long enough, I don't wind up in a nursing home or something. But I can imagine sitting there saying, hey, he did it, or he's trying to do it. I think it's a long way from now, Bill, W2SAWWS2N.
Yeah, Paul, it sounds like maybe your great-great-grandchildren might see it, but I think I'd have to go with Dick on this. Sounds pretty far-fetched, really.
I know. I was always, naturally, I'm going to push for the most optimistic outcome, because I do the SpaceNet report, but Dick was, of course, always, I don't see this happening anytime soon, and of course he's right, but I don't know, it's nice to dream. Look at Elon Musk. I remember, it had to be 2010, he was developing, before that, 2009, he was developing the Falcon Heavy, and that's the one. You take three of these Falcon boosters and you bolt them together, side by side, and you could wind up with a 5.5 million pounds of thrust, and that's why he eventually did it. But he thought this was going to happen in 2013, right? So 2013 came and went, but he predicted it. He was originally was going to launch it out of California, but sure enough, he did launch it, and it turned out to be about 5 years late. It wound up going in not last year, but the year before, and it was February 6th, and he launched the three boosters together, and he needed a dead weight inside. Sometimes they just use. They call it usually a mass. Let me drop it. A weight. In the olden days, they used to put in concrete, but you needed to put some kind of weight in there. Nobody wanted it to risk putting their satellites in there, their $100 million satellites, whatever they're building, in case this thing didn't work. So he put his car in there. He put a car that he actually drove, a Tesla car, and he put a spacesuit in there. It looked like somebody sitting in the car. And I'm sure you probably remember that this was on the news and everything. And he launches, this vehicle from Florida, from Launch Complex 39A, went into orbit, and then he went into He broke orbit. That means he had to get up to 25,000 miles an hour instead of 17,500 miles an hour, which he did with no problem with these massive rockets. Two of the boosters came back and landed successfully in there. In Florida, they called landing zone one and landing zone two successfully. No problem. You see those pictures, you can bring it up on the internet, and you see these two boosters landing simultaneously. It looks like an animation. And the third booster in the middle was supposed to land on the boat. It just missed the boat. Very close, but no cigar. And then he tried again. He actually did this mission, these three rockets bolted together. He actually did two missions after one after the other. He did one for the Arabs, and he did one for the military, our military. And it's the same thing. The boosters made it back to land successfully. But the center booster, one of them completely, I think, went out of control, and the other one just didn't make it. I think one made it. One made it, but it fell over on the boat. And the reason for it, the Octa Grabber wasn't designed to grab the center core of this Falcon Heavy. Since that time, though, he has developed the Octa Grabber, that robotic thing that comes out of a garage and is able to. Which is another one of these things, I think, early next year. Be the next Falcon Heavy. His goal is eventually to try to save all three. But now it turns out, get back to, he was supposed to do this in 2013, and he made that prediction, and the years went by, and everybody said, he's got to be kidding. Sure enough, 5 years later, he made it happen. He tends to do that with a lot of his predictions of what he's doing, when he's going to successfully land the booster. And he was a couple of years off on that, too. But now he's done, I think, 55 of them have successfully been landed. So his predictions are a little off, but they tend to come true. So I kind of go like that myself. Certain things I back off on. This landing of somebody in 2024 on the moon, I'm not going with that. I'm going with 2028. Any questions or comments? WS2N.
Any idea where that car has got to? Are we tracking it?
The car? Yeah, well, it's actually in heliocentric orbit. I mean, he actually launched it toward Mars. He didn't want to hit Mars. The car was never sterilized. When you launch a vehicle from Earth to a planet, it's sterilized. All the rovers that have gone and all the landers, the Phoenix lander and the InSight lander and the two earliest ones, Viking landers that were launched in the 1970s were super sterilized, So I don't think NASA would have been happy if he aimed for Mars and hit it with his car, it's in heliocentric orbit, so transmitter stopped a long time ago, and he feels someday in the future some alien race is going to find it, and they're going to say, what the heck is this car doing in orbit? Back to you.
Thanks, Paul. He's certainly a bit of a character, but I really don't see the Mars thing happening for another 100 years. Thanks, Paul. W2SAW.
I remember as a teenager, there was some guy, some artist, and the space program was really going, You never thought there was going to be... decided to stop Apollo at Apollo 17. They had plans to go to Apollo 20. They had boosters ready to go, but people were in the cars. The one guy had a plan. He wanted to land. I think it was a 1955 Chevy. His goal was to land it on the moon, and that's what this thing reminded me of. This guy putting a Tesla vehicle in orbit around the sun, a heliocentric orbit. I don't know. Any other questions or comments? Okay. I know Roy will appreciate this story. Dr. Kate Rubin, who's really into biology and all of this DNA stuff, she's an astronaut, and she's been up before. A few years ago, back in 2015, I think it was, 15 and 16. And she was up there with Jeff Williams and a couple of, they had somebody from the European Space Agency, and they had two Russians. There were six people flying around on that space station. She did some spacewalks, helped out with these batteries, this ongoing battery problem that I was talking about before, that Japan is bringing up these 400-pound batteries, you know, six of them to replace 12. Kate Rubin's main job, why they really wanted her on the space station, was she's an expert in all this biology, and they sent up a sequencer, a DNA sequencer, for the space station. She was the first one to sequence DNA on the space station. Now, I don't know what I'm talking about, because this has to do with, you know, real biology. But it was, in that world, it's a big deal. Big deal to do this, especially in space. And why do they need that to do that in space? So on long missions, you know, you go off to Mars or Saturn, wherever you're going to go to, it might be a requirement to, you know, to find out what some germ is. They might find a germ attached to the, you know, to the spacecraft on the inside or maybe the outside, you know. And they want to be able to figure out what's the deal here. And it was, you know, you can't send it back to Earth, you know, you're on the way to Mars. So they'd have this machine there, and they would be able to sequence the DNA, and I would tell them something. Dr. Roy would be able to tell me what it's going to tell me and why it's good, but I don't know. But nevertheless, there's a part two to this, and there's another piece of equipment. I don't know what it is yet, but whatever it is, she's going to be working on that. She's originally raised in Connecticut, of course, born from us. I'm born in Connecticut, raised in California. But very talented with all this stuff. And just an everyday good astronaut, from what I see. So she's going up again. And she's going to be going up this year, October 18th. We talked about Doug Hurley and Benkin, and you have now another crew ready to go up on August 30th on a Crew Dragon 2 mission. The second crew that will be going up. There's going to be four people at one time. And then missions after that will eventually be planned, including... I finally timed it out. They'll be able to send people as well on Boeing. So, you know, you would think, well, never going to need the Russians again. I mean, the idea is to get away from the Russians. Nobody wants to pay $80 million to, you know, made an arrangement with Space Adventures, they call it. Space Adventures set, you know, made a contract with Russia, and Russia loves these kinds of deals. NASA doesn't. NASA really is not into sending up Russia $18 million for, you know, a 7-day trip up to the International Space Station at the time, back in 2001. You know, so, you know, had, you know, since then, eight other people have done that, or eight other trips. One guy was a repeat. Did it twice. But you would say, well, we don't need the Russians anymore. We have a Dragon crew vehicle, we have the Starliner by Boeing, which is true. But, you know, we're going to be taking other people up. For instance, the next flight, we're going to take three Americans and one person from JAXA, which is the Japanese space agency. But, you know, right now we have a crew of five on board. We want to have minimum of a crew of six. That means the Russians would be, they only need two people. They don't want any more than two people, two Russians on board. That means there's always going to be an extra seat, and my guess for a reduced price, because we don't really need them anymore. They made a deal for Kate to revisit the International Space Station for at least 6 months, starting in October. So I thought that was interesting to, you know, not only that, you know, we're going to still use the Russian Soyuz vehicle to launch an American astronaut. And, you know, what will happen in the future is we are partners, even with the Russians on this. What will happen eventually, we'll actually take a Russian or two up on one of our vehicles as well. And, you know, actually, the head of the Russian space agency, Roscosmos, told NASA, you know, maybe we'll do this, but not now. We're not putting the first crew manifest of the first few flights will not involve any Russians. But down the road, I could see that happening. It is an international space station. 20 countries involved, including the Russians, Japan, you know. So that's the story on that. Any questions or comments? WS2N. Okay, I talked about the Starlink program already. I haven't really that much. I just wanted to bring up a story about Annie Glenn. Annie Glenn was the wife of John Glenn. Naturally, John Glenn, first astronaut to orbit Earth, and he was that old enough. We actually sat there and watched him do that, make three orbits and come back. And anybody that's young enough, I'm sure, read that in the history books. And, you know, they're not going to talk about the 500 and some odd people that have been into space so far. I mean, that would be overwhelming. But I'm sure they talk about Alan Shepard. They probably should talk about Yuri Gagarin, first man. Alan Shepard, first man to actually, American to go into space. Gagarin to orbit. Valentina Tereshchukova for the Russians to send the first woman up. We had Sally Ride, you know. The space program really started with these seven guys, the Mercury astronauts, and one of them was John Glenn. He's married to Annie Glenn. So Annie Glenn, turned out the astronauts and you know, how to handle themselves, and you know, these people were sticking their necks out. It wasn't like Russia. Russia would, you know, launch somebody, and then after they came back, if it was successful, they'd say, oh, yeah, no, we did a launch. We put them on a launch pad, you know, 3, 2, 1, and off they went, and they showed the wives. And she was very helpful with the disabled, the elderly. She had a speech impediment herself her whole life, and she worked on that. Eventually was able to give speeches. But otherwise, she made it to John Glenn died a few years ago himself, but after being senator. She eventually made it, you know, to 100 years old. She was born in 1920, and here we are in 2020. And she just died in May. And it turns out, what did she die of? COVID-19. So, back to the COVID-19 story. With that, I'm going to turn it back to Roy. I've come to the end of my list here. AC2GS, this is WS2M for the Space Night Report. Tomorrow, anybody who wants to check in, you can. You don't have to be a member. You check in to the club InfoNet. Also on this frequency. Back to you, Roy. You know, any comments from you, or what are we going to do here? Back to you, Roy.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. If you want to talk a little bit about the gene sequencing, it's a kind of exciting field in biology. You realize that up until about 20 years ago, it was very difficult to get any kind of gene sequences, but because most likely the Human Genome Project accelerated the automated breakdown and decoding of genomes, It's made genetic decrypting, if you will, very very easy and relatively inexpensive. This is why when I discuss things like the coronaviruses, the genetic drift, the thousands of different gene sequence mutations that have been picked up are due to thousands of genetic runs of the material. So it's very useful to do gene sequencing. You can figure out all kinds of things. You can identify organisms. You can identify routes that they might have taken as they mutated across different regions. There's all kinds of fun stuff that you could do with that technology, and it was inevitable that they would be able to put it onto a microgravity environment. You know, more test equipment is always better than less. I don't think they'll be doing a lot of exogenetic sequencing of alien life forms, but there's probably still a lot of things that they can analyze within the confines of their own environment.
Yeah, and I mentioned that, you know, in the filters, you know, they wind up with these, like some, it's called mole or bacteria or something, and they said they, for some reason, they would like to be able to test that, I guess, figure out what it is. But, yeah, I just don't know why. I mean, they really make a big deal out of this. You know, you read the NASA sites and the science sites, they talk about this. As if it's, you know, like it wasn't going to be possible, you know. I wonder what you think. I mean, do you think it's really a big advancement that they could do it in microgravity? Did you think that, you know, that was going to really play a role? Like, oh my God, you know, every time we try it, it don't work, and it turns out, you know, it worked the first time and it worked every time when they did it. You know, do you think that taking, you know, doing something different, chemicals, or I know that they're not, you know, creating their own artificial gravity to do this. I mean, they could do that on the space station, but it's in a complete microgravity environment. So I'm just wondering why did they think they were going to have problems? And like when she did it last time, I mean, they made a big deal out of it. So I guess it must have been. Must have been worth it, you know. Back to you, Roy.
Well, the present design, as far as I'm aware, is it's a very automated system. So it's, you know, you kind of set it up and turn it on and walk away, and because it gets monotonous after a while. So my guess would be under microgravity conditions, you have to modify the test equipment that it somewhat relies on gravity to help the process go. And another part of it I've seen in the past where NASA kind of milks things for public relations things, you know, they will never turn down a press release. So it's probably a little bit of both.
You really didn't know what they were doing. You just see pictures of Dr. Rubin sitting at this, not sitting, but, you know, they secured themselves to the... they have hundreds of these racks all throughout the space station. She's in Destiny. Destiny is the American science module that we have attached. You know, it's 30 feet long and 14 feet in diameter. So equipment and computers all over. But one of the stations is this DNA sequencing station. And you just have pictures of the doctor sitting there doing this. So, but you really don't know what, you know, I don't know what they're doing. It might, you know, like you said, it might be automatic. You know, they take a picture of that and then they fly away and do something else, come back. So, I don't know. A lot of science is being done on board station. They're looking at, right now there's 400 ongoing experiments, over 400. Back to you, Roy.
Well, yeah, I mean, some of it is kind of very interesting because there are some things that gravity has an impact. When you're growing crystals, gravitational forces can cause yields to go down. So there are actually benefits to some processes using microgravity, and in other cases there are impediments that you have to design around to get the something that's very easy to get on Earth to work there. So there's a whole bunch of different reasons for a whole bunch of different scientific studies, and, you know, publish or perish is the old saying among PhDs. So they're generating a lot of research papers, and that's the currency of a part of the NASA program, are to generate those papers. So, you know, some of it are very useful and very interesting. Some of them are, gee, I wonder what happens if we take some beans and grow them in microgravity, sort of one.
Yeah, that's true. Which they do. They have the veggie experiments up there. It's 1 meter square, and they recently doubled the size of that, and they actually grow, and they do grow stuff. And the first time they grew it, they sent it back to Earth, make sure, test it out, make sure it's okay, and then if they get, when they got the okay, they would, they'd not eat the stuff. But one experiment I like is they always used to test flames, and, you know, how things burn in different materials. They have it's all encased. You know, they have a glass in front of it. But, you know, they've advanced to the point they would like to see how it's really spread into a big, you know, they had a bigger environment with more materials and more stuff. But to do that, they said, well, let's not do this on the space station. They used the Cygnus cargo vehicle. That's one of the vehicles that gets set up on a regular basis. You have all these cargo vehicles. You got the Progress cargo vehicle from the Russians. You have the Dragon cargo vehicle from SpaceX. You have the HCV from Japan. You also have the Cygnus vehicle from now it's Northrop Grumman. It used to be Orbital ATK. Northrop Grumman bought them up, and they send the Cygnus vehicle up and unload everything, and it stays docked to the station for months on end. They fill it all up with junk and trash, and they want to get rid of it. But inside the Cygnus vehicle, they have now they call it the Safer experiment. They test by it. It's in a big enclosed box inside the vehicle. And when it departs from the space station, you know, eventually this vehicle gets burnt up in the atmosphere anyway, but it departs from the space station. They leave it in orbit for weeks, sometimes months, when we drop it. But now, you know, they've gone from the science of testing it inside the space station to the science of testing on Cygnus. And Mission Control ignites it, and it's inside the spacecraft. They have all kinds of instruments and monitors, and, you know, they want to see, you know, I guess if there's a fire on a space station, they want to know how things are going to burn and, you know, how it's going to move and how we could better protect things. Interesting thing. They've done this at least three different times that I know of with three different spacecraft. So, terrific sign to get out of this. And unfortunately, that doesn't make the news, you know. Yeah, the manned missions and the robotic missions to Mars, and, you know, but there's a lot of science coming out of it, you know. And, you know, that's, I guess, a little too mundane for everyday news. You know, I guess you have to look into the different websites or even the library. Back to you, Roy, WS2X.
AC2GS. Well, the problem with news is you have to be able to package it in very short news bites. You have to generate pretty pictures for people to look at very quickly. Attention span is not what it once was. So the scientific journals are fascinating, but many people do not find it as fascinating as I do. So it's understandable that a lot of this stuff ends up in footnotes someplace. And most people are unaware, and NASA used to be very good at publicity and promoting all kinds of things, so hopefully they'll get back on that particular stick. I was wondering, Paul, if you've had a chance to, or you've heard about, there's a new sitcom called Space Force on Netflix?
I heard about it. I haven't seen it yet. Is that the one that's a comedy?
Yeah, it's a comedy with Steve Carell. There was one particular episode that I found particularly amusing. They had a They had an isolation on Earth to kind of simulate lunar environmental claustrophobia and what have you. And inside the living area that they were locked into for X number of weeks, I'm not quite sure how long, the only thing that they had was potatoes. The guy would open up the refrigerator and you would see nothing but bins filled with potatoes. And all they were growing were potatoes. So I remember your and Dick's conversations about the Martian.
Yeah, the guy was sick of potatoes. And I think you said...